This episode of NABIP's Healthcare Happy Hour is brought to you by AffirmedRx. Looking for a better way to manage pharmacy benefits? AffirmedRx is a next-generation pharmacy benefit manager and the only one structured as a public benefit corporation. That means they put people before profits. They partner with employers, hospital systems, and organizations that value transparency, clinical integrity, and a member-first experience. AffirmedRx is driving real change in an industry that needs it. Learn more at AffirmedRx.com.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals.
And to talk more with us about what's going on, we have invited the VP of Strategic Alliances at AffirmedRx, Mike Stancil, to join us. Hey, Mike, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, David. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. You know, I mentioned in the open that you guys are a public corporation. I don't know that an awful lot of people really know what that is. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So a public benefit corporation is kind of a unique setup, right? Like, I think most people are familiar with for-profit organizations, and then they're very familiar with nonprofit organizations. And I think, you know, both of those have their places in the total economy and marketplace. But in healthcare particularly, you have some tensions that I think emerge out of both. I think in the for-profit realm, if you're out there in healthcare and your only driver, your only motivation from fiduciary responsibility, right? Like if you're a CEO to the shareholders is to drive more profit, that really kind of eliminates a lot of the safeguards that we might want in place that protect the people at the end of the service, right? And I think that's oftentimes seen as the reason why our healthcare market is the way it is right now, is everybody sort of relentlessly went after profits at the expense of the actual service that's being delivered. On the flip side, you have nonprofits, right, which are mission driven, and they're supposed to live up to that mission, and you know, they bring in revenue to maintain operations and to fund their mission and their work, but they're less, you know, less driven by revenue. Now, I will say, in most cases, if you say a healthcare nonprofit, there's usually a chuckle, an eye roll, or something, some combination of the two. And I think that indicates about how well most people perceive those organizations as living up to that. And I think there's also some issues with nonprofits perpetuating inefficiency. I worked for a university a long time ago, and I remember at one point it was coming to the end of the fiscal season, and we hadn't spent our entire budget for the department that I was in, and there was this mad rush to buy things because if we didn't spend our entire budget, that budget would be cut, right? So there's these sort of rewards baked in oftentimes that reward that inefficiency. So the public benefit corporation is a for-profit company, but it is legally obligated as part of its filing to accomplish some public good that you have to state. So for us, it's to do the most good for the most people, and to put the patients or people over profit. And what's unique about being a public benefit corporation is that you have to get 100% of your shareholders to sign off on that designation. So that means that everybody, every accountable party within the organization has agreed that that is your mission. And so that guard gets put into place, and you have to report biennially on the public good that you've done. And it really puts these parameters in place because we are a for-profit company. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, as I mentioned, right, being a for-profit company means that you're going to be more innovative, right? You're trying to compete in an open market to come up with new solutions that can better serve your product and your customer. And, you know, it allows you to, or it encourages you to operate more efficiently and more leanly. But then when you get to that place where we have to continue to grow, or we have to continue to bring in more revenue. And those decisions start to get more difficult down the line as you become an older company. Having that public benefit designation keeps the guide rails on that says, sure, you can continue to try to make more money. You can continue to grow and to innovate, but you cannot do it at the expense of people's lives and their health. And I think that's a really important designation, especially for an organ, like for a market like the PBM industry, which has been around for 30 plus years, right? They know how to extract all these dollars. So it's sort of like, okay, well, let's keep things honest, let's keep things right, and let's keep people as that first principle of everything that we do.
So in a practical sense, overlay that on your business model, how you go to market, what you talk to employers about, how does that actually affect what you and the brokers that rep you put out on the street?
So starting from the employer perspective, right, we had the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021 that went through and expanded their fiduciary requirements under ERISA, right? And so now we have these lawsuits in place that I'm sure everyone's familiar with, where there's real risk on the line. So we are 100% transparent with everything that we do. So to meet that goal, we came designed to say, all the data, all the information, and everything that we do is not ours. It is the client's. It is 100% there. You have all the audit rights down to ingredient level. Every little detail you want, we will give to you. We're not afraid of that. Our contracts are really transparent, really easy to understand. There's no convolutions there. And we take that charge very seriously in engaging with them. It also means that when we're working with them, that we're not engaging in spread pricing, right? Where we negotiate a certain rate from a pharmaceutical manufacturer, turn around and charge them a different amount, and they don't know which one is which, right? And they don't know what we paid, why they're being paid what they're why they're paying what they're paying. And so we're transparent in that route, right? So we pass through all charges, so they know what we're paying, they pay the same. There's no markups on drugs, there's no money that we make. We only make revenue on a flat admin fee, and that admin fee includes everything that we do, and that's per script. So, and it's actually per script filled, so we only get paid on prescriptions that are filled and for the actual client. We also don't own any pharmacies or distribution channels. Like, we have no horizontal or vertical integration. And this is to eliminate those conflicts of interest. Like, a lot of organizations that have a big focus on maximizing rebates, for example, they do that because they're usually either taking a piece of the rebates, or maybe they have arrangements where they can get extra dollars if they're driving those things, driving traffic to that on the formulary, or certain drugs on the formulary. And some other PBMs are actually starting to white label their own drugs and put those in formulary. We're not doing any of that. We will never do any of that, because that creates too many conflicts of interest where you're not actually driving lowest cost. You're not driving clinical efficacy. You're focused on the numbers game and the money game rather than actually getting people the best quality care at the lowest possible cost. And so that's a pretty big thing. When it comes to our, to like the actual patient and people, that's really where our PBM approach, I think, differs from the rest of the market, which is our patient care advocates. So our patient care advocates are placed specifically for each client that we have, and they're exclusive to that client, so they're hired specifically for them. And their job is to proactively review the claims as they come through and the scripts as they go through, and to intercept, find, to eliminate problems, right? Like, if they see that there are prior authorizations, or if there are things in place that will make it difficult for the patient to get access to their medication, they're intervening and they're starting to go through that process and informing the patient everything that needs to be done and helping facilitate that, as well as looking for cost savings opportunities at that point on behalf of the patient while communicating. There's no call center. The patient doesn't have to call them. This is being done proactively. And the goal there really is to kind of erase the PBM experience from everyday life. Like, I don't know about you, but I don't wake up every morning and like think about my PBM, right, that we work with, or anybody that works with their company, like they know their pharmacist, they know their provider, and they know where their drugs come from, usually the pharmacy. I think most people probably think Express Scripts and think of CVS instead is just a pharmacy, right? The one's the mail order and one's not, right? And really, we just want to, like, we don't want you to think about us at all. The ideal situation is your doctor prescribes you a medicine, you go to the pharmacy and you pick it up, and it costs you less than you're expecting, right? Or it's the lowest possible cost, and then you get treated and you get better. And that's there shouldn't be more thought behind it than that. And I think that's a big piece of that public benefit focus as well.
What's the state of market awareness about the difference between what you guys are doing and what the big three, let's say, are doing? Do employers, are they at the point now? I know there's been a lot of talk in Washington about PBM and PBM reform and the recent law. I know it's being challenged in Arkansas about PBMs owning pharmacies and such. Are you seeing more awareness?
Yes, and it's a really... It's a really highly focused area right now for, I would say, 50 going on 60% of the total employer market. I would say 50 to 60% are really dialed in and paying attention. I'm not going to say they're all ready to switch, but they're at least asking the right questions or starting to go down that path. You know, if you're an employer, a self-insured employer, and you should, if you're not a member of a regional health coalition, business health coalition, like the Midwest Business Group on Health is a great one. They're all great. There's a Florida Alliance for Healthcare Value. They're all over. There's three in Texas. Join one, because I'll say that the employers that we've engaged with that are involved in those coalition spaces are usually ahead of the curve. So there's a little bit of like a bubble, right? So when it's there's nuance when you ask that question, because I think the people that are involved in the coalitions and that are in that space are dialed in, and they're having the in-depth conversations with their consultants and saying, we need to rekey our RFP process. We need to move away from the big three. The remaining 50 to 40%, are, I think, oftentimes caught in the minds, like the financial games that are being played that really convolute and make it difficult to see where the dollars are actually going. So they're just not as aware of their liability, of the risk that they're taking on. But they're also, I think, completely blinded by maybe really big rebate checks or sort of all the additional add-ons that the big three can kind of throw in to make it look like there's savings processes in place or fraud, waste, and abuse tacked on that, even though they're like, we'll save you more money, but it has a cost. And you're just going, wait a second, like, how come year over year you're adding more, which is costing me more, but you're saying it's saving me money? It's like they pull that bait and switch a lot. And if you look at trend year over year, all their costs are going up pretty predictably. And you know that none of these big three are ever going to take less money, right? They're never going to do that. So if they tell you they are, then yeah, something fishy's going on.
Well, but it's amazing. We're going to take money out of your left pocket and we'll put some of it back in your right pocket. And so you're better off in your right pocket than you were before. And it's kind of like, I don't know, pharmaceutical three-card Monty.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where the employers are at. What are you seeing in the broker community? Other than, I know there's a cadre of brokers who are out creating bespoke solutions on the self-funded platforms for folks. Are you seeing beyond those folks, are you seeing more awareness just in the general broker community about advising their clients to ask for something different or to look for something different?
Yes, there are definitely a few larger firms that are, I think, really putting some attention on this. It varies, I think, a lot depending, so a lot of the larger firms are they own, right? They grow through acquisition. So they own a lot of these regional firms, and the variance within those regional firms can be pretty dramatic, right? So there are definitely some markets that are just really, really dialed in, really focused. I'd say like Indiana as a state is just dialed in, even on a state legislative approach. They're really focused on this. So a lot of the consultants in those areas and brokers in those areas are really open to working with the big three, or sorry, away from the big three PBMs. I think the tension really right now is one, because they have a tried and true RFP process, they have a tendency to just use that same RFP process, which just because of by the way it's designed and the way the market has existed, tends to perpetuate and advantage the big three or traditional PBM model. And I don't think it's laziness. I don't think they're not doing the right work for their clients. I think it's just sort of like, you know, it's a means of efficiency, right? As you grow and you get things down and you do them effectively, you start to templatize it so you can roll it out more quickly and more efficiently. And I think that's just what's happened. And so it gets very difficult to change direction. And so we are seeing some areas where a lot of the change is being driven by the employer, you know, reaching out to their brokers and consultants, and they're saying, hey, look, we really want to include one of these new wave transparent pass-through PBMs into our RFP process. And unfortunately, because they're great brokers and consultants and they listen, they say, absolutely, we're going to roll them in. The unfortunately part comes in because they roll them into that existing RFP process. And that's where things get a little bit difficult. But even that, we're starting to see some really great changes. We had a call with an employer just this week. And towards the end of the call, the employer said, so my final question is, what can I do? What can I ask my broker or consultant to do with this RFP to make sure that we're getting an apples to apples comparison and to make sure that, you know, we're moving away from the big three? And I was
great
like,
question. Great yeah, question.
I was like, that is the right question to ask. I'm like, just asking that question feels like a win. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot of like work that needs to be done in those spaces, but I think the attention's there and people are heading in that direction, gradually, which is awesome. I got off and I was talking to, you know, one of my colleagues and was just sort of like, awesome. Now the questions are getting more difficult. So now we're going to have to really dial in those answers because we finally got them asking the right questions.
But that's a happy problem.
It is. It's the exact problem that you want to have.
Because, absolutely.
You know, I think there comes a time where you don't want to win because you're not evil. You want to win because you've got the best product. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've got a little bit of time left. I'm curious as to what's going on in the universe of specialty meds, because if I understand the stats right, about 2% of the scripts are specialty meds, but they're driving more than half of all pharma costs. What's happening in that universe? Is there any relief coming?
So specialty meds is one of those complicated areas. I think to say that there's a silver bullet, would be a bit of a stretch because of the different costs. So one fun thing is that specialty medication doesn't have a definition. So PBMs can use designations like that to just exclude things from formulary or to pawn them off on a specialty pharmacy. The standard issue that we see right now is that the specialty pharmaceutical market has been for a long time cornered by these sort of vertically integrated PBMs where they also own the specialty delivery. And then they're, you know, white labeling drugs where they can, and they keep that revenue in place and they drive to certain drugs that might not be as clinically effective. And there really has to be an approach that takes a look at starting with clinical efficacy, then looking at what's in the market as far as biosimilars and generics that can be utilized effectively to offset those costs, And then you have to put in place something that's, you know, like a prior authorization, you know, depending on, and a lot of this comes down to what the plan sponsor actually wants, right? Like how they want to approach their spend to control the right costs and get access to the right medications in the right way. There are certain things that are out there like international sourcing that we don't engage with because they are legally in a gray area. And because of that sort of public benefit approach, we don't like dipping our toe in there. We think there are ways through just intelligent formulary design, starting with that clinical analysis, then cost analysis, we're able to start shifting, you know, things through. The big question, the big thing that I think is, I don't have a clean answer or something that I could give you probably with the time that we have remaining. And also I would feel a little bit out of my depth speaking to are the things that are coming down the line with cell and gene therapies. So though this is a big issue for a lot of employers because they carry massive price tags, but they also carry, you know, oftentimes curative, you know, they're going to be curative for diseases that are either horrific or life-changing. And nobody wants to say no, but they also don't know how they're going to pay for them. And there are some things in place and some new approaches that are emerging that I think are on the cusp of becoming a reality. I think the biggest ones right now that people are looking at turnkey are doing diagnostics, doing tests to make sure that these medications are actually going to work for a particular individual before you even try them. And going through that process can help sort of eliminate that waste or spending money on a, you know, cutting edge therapeutic that might not actually work for them.
Well, and the cost of pharmacogenetic testing has come down some from where it was a couple of years ago. So maybe we'll start seeing, you know, more of that. Great place to end our conversation. And as that matures, we hope you'll come back and talk to us about it. Mike Stansel, VP of Strategic Alliances at AffirmedRx. Mike, thanks for a fascinating conversation.
David, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You can have the Healthcare Happy Hour podcast downloaded automatically by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also find a link to the podcast in the member-exclusive Washington Update, published on Fridays. For more information on our government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit nabip.org.